had a very high opinion of his ability as a journalist and as a speaker, and was a very good speaker, rarely needed much editorial change, but occasionally we might, in going through our transcript, we might change a word that we had transcribed and transcribed incorrectly and put in the correct word as a result of checking our shorthand note or checking the tape. And when we sent that to Paul Hasluck, my recollection is that he often looked at his own greens, didn't leave it to his staff to do it, and because he thought that change on the typescript was something that we had changed from what he had said, he would change it back again. But in fact, what he was doing was just the opposite of what he thought he was doing. and then there was another member who insisted on introducing his question in a particular way. Whereas sometimes a member would begin his question by saying, "My question is directed to the Prime Minister. Is the Prime Minister aware?" Well, often we would leave out that first sentence and start off, "Is the Prime Minister aware?" straight into it. Well, there was one particular member who insisted on retaining the way he introduced his question. He always started off by saying, "I ask the Minister for so-and-so," and then he'd go into his question. And whereas with another member, we might have just gone straight into, "Is the Minister aware, so-and-so, so-and-so?" But we always, for that member, we always knew we had to put in, "I ask the Minister for so-and-so." Mm. Sorry, I've got a little bit away from McMahon, because he was one who did make, or he or his office, made changes to the Hansard report.
What was your impression of him as a speaker?
I suppose the impression was his high-pitched voice. Not a good speaking voice, but he wasn't Robinson Crusoe in that respect. Arthur Calwell is the worst example of somebody who had a terrible speaking voice, and which detracted markedly from his presentation. Arthur Calwell used to make wonderful, magnificent speeches. He was very well read, very well educated, made great speeches, and they read exceedingly well on paper, but as I say, his voice was terrible. So was McMahon's. McMahon had that high-pitched voice, but he was a pretty reasonable speaker, trained as a lawyer and as an economist, and spoke quite well.
Mm. Now we come to 1972.
Come to 1972, and in my estimation, Whitlam is right up there with Menzies, because I've already referred to my introduction to the House of Reps chamber when he walked in the door the very night that I came, the day I arrived in Canberra. It's always seemed to me that Gough Whitlam had a special relationship with Hansard, partly because he had grown up, spent so much time here in Canberra. He had actually gone to school with a couple of people who were on our Hansard staff. His father had been a very senior Commonwealth public servant. Whitlam had a great respect, in my opinion, for public servants and parliamentary officers, and of course for the Parliament itself. He was one of the clearest speakers we ever had in the Parliament, always put his sentences together so well and so clearly, required very little editing. And then, once Hansard was produced, he made very good use of Hansard. In my experience, he probably made more use of Hansard than any other member or senator. He would get his daily Hansard, he would go through it and prepare a little index of his speeches or questions in that daily Hansard and of any other members' speeches or questions that he thought he might need to refer to at some later time. And then I think I've referred to the, I may not have in this in these interviews, referred to the indexes that we prepared. We prepared a speeches index for each member and senator. And it was not in the traditional librarian type indexing style. But our Hansard indexes were not available until after the end of each sessional period. So Gough Whitlam, through the sessional period, he would prepare an index for himself, his own index, according to our Hansard style. And very soon after the end of the sessional period, he would send his version of his index to us. And we would then incorporate his suggested index entries into our prepared index for his speeches. And then he would use those indexes and he would use the Hansards in his campaigning. And my understanding that in the 1969 election, he used all the Hansard references to his speeches and to Sir John Gorton's speeches to great effect. Remembering that that 1969 election was critical to this subsequent victory at the 1972 election. He was really a godsend for Hansard reporters because of his speaking and because of the respect he had and the use that he made of Hansard. But by the same token, as we all know, he had his faults. Some people might say arrogance, petulance. The incident with Paul Hasluck is probably the worst example of unparliamentary conduct by such a senior parliamentarian.
Were you there when that happened?
No, I certainly don't remember being there, but we all knew it happened. And there are lots of things that we all knew about and became so well aware of that sometimes it's difficult to remember whether you were actually there or whether you know so much about it that you think you might have been there, but in fact you weren't. But I don't recall being there in the chamber when that glass of water incident happened. Another example of his arrogance is too strong a word. Pomposity might be a more appropriate word. I don't know, but I think it was at the end of 1973. I might be wrong about that, but when he had arranged for Graham Frydenberg and other members of his staff to prepare a list of all what he saw as the achievements of his Whitlam government. And this was a very extensive list. And right towards the end of the sessional period, he came into the House and he sought leave to have that document, which had a Latin title, which many people will remember, but I can't recite it off the top of my head. He sought leave to have that document incorporated in Hansard. And the opposition refused him leave. And of course, you have to have only one member to refuse leave for a leave to be denied. And that's what happened in that case. So he then proceeded to read the whole document into Hansard. And my recollection, and from reading the books, is that it took nearly 2 hours to read that document into Hansard. So I certainly acknowledge, and most other people acknowledge, that he had his failings, but he really was very highly regarded by me and by most other Hansard reporters of that time.
You mentioned earlier when you spoke about Sir Robert Menzies that when he came into the chamber, the atmosphere seemed to change. It became more serious, more focused on Menzies. What sort of effect did it? You also mentioned that you said that Whitlam was right up there in terms of as an operator and as a parliamentarian. Did Whitlam have the same effect on?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because Menzies had been Prime Minister since 1949, all through the time. He'd been the national leader all of that time. Whereas Whitlam was only the deputy leader through those early years in the 60s. And even he was a leader for only a relatively short time before he won the election in 1972. So he didn't have the same effect as Menzies in my view.
You also mentioned that he thought the relationship between Whitlam and Hansard was quite different to that between Hansard and any other prime minister. Did he have any personal personal dealings with staff or?
I mentioned that there were two members on the staff who'd gone to school with him, and one of those was the main administrative person, the administrative officer. He wasn't a reporter, he was an administrative officer. They would have had personal contact from time to time. It wasn't all that usual for members or senators to come to our office and deal face to face with us. There were some members who did that. There's one quite prominent member who was not a very good speaker, and who would, after he'd made his speech and got his greens, would himself come to the office and sit down next to one of our Hansard people and go through his speech and ask, could he change this, and would it be okay if he used that word instead of another word, and in effect go right through the speech, sometimes kneeling down if it wasn't going to take too long, but otherwise he'd have to provide a chair for him, and he'd go through the speech. But he was exceptional. Most of the others didn't deal on a personal basis like that with us. On a personal basis, when I was a PPR, I can remember one occasion when I got a phone call from Gough Whitlam when he was in Paris as ambassador at UNESCO. And I don't think I'm telling any secrets that after, well, while Whitlam was a member, he made a practice of asking questions on notice which required lots of detailed information about all sorts of subjects in which he was interested. And after he left the parliament, he arranged with one or two Labor members to put questions on the notice paper on his behalf. And then the answers would appear in Hansard, and there would be the information that he wanted to keep and to correlate with the other information on the same subject that he'd been collecting over the years. And a little bit of detail, but for questions without notice and questions with on notice, we were required to put a subject heading on those. And we tried to be consistent so that people could follow through a line of questioning. And I remember one occasion when I got a phone call from Paris and he just wanted to say hello, and he said he'd received his daily Hansard for such and such a date. Thank you very much. It's always good to get the daily Hansard and keep up to date. But would you mind if I suggested a different heading on this particular answer to question? So he obviously had previous questions on that subject, and we had chosen to put a different subject heading on this question, and he just would like to have the question headings consistent.
And did you?
I think we probably did.
Even though he wasn't a member of parliament. So did you have any, apart from that, did you have any personal dealings with Gough Whitlam?
Not that I can recall, no.
Mm-hmm. And then there was Malcolm Fraser.
Virtually nothing that I can remember that we had dealings with Malcolm Fraser. He's not a Prime Minister or even a member who would have come to the Hansard office frequently, if at all.
How was he in Parliament, well, as a Speaker and as, I suppose, as the Prime Minister?
Well, again, a highly educated man and a good speaker. Required very little editing, always clear. No real problems at all. I think he must have had pretty good staff, and again, I don't recall that we had any great difficulty in having to reject any suggested corrections or alterations. I suppose the one little thing that stands out in my mind about Malcolm Fraser in relation to things to do with Hansard is that, unbelievably, on one occasion he wanted to refer to something as grandiose, and he pronounced it as grandoise. And of course, apart from it being a mispronunciation, it presented quite serious problems in when that was picked up and other members started to shyack him about the mispronunciation. How were we going to show this mispronunciation in Hansard? But apart from that little thing that sticks in my mind, we didn't really have any difficulties with Malcolm Fraser. To a large extent, and apart from Gough Whitlam, I think the Prime Ministers had much more significant issues to deal with and to devote their attention to than Hansard. Important as it was something that could be left basically to their staffs to look after, unless there was some problem arose. But problems hardly ever arose.
So I suppose, am I interpreting it this right, to that in a sense, from on the hand side, reporter's point of view, and from your point of view, you were doing a job, and whatever was served up was, that was what you did, and so the politics or the theatre, the theatrical aspects of Parliament or anything like that really didn't come into it.
That's right. We were concentrating on the words, and always trying to get as the best understanding we could possibly get of the speech and the subject matter, but recognising that as a generalisation, certainly our level of education and general education was quite a bit lower than most of the prime ministers in particular and many of the other members and senators. With a very wide range of experience and education levels among senators and members, it was impossible for us to have as good an understanding of the subject matter as the members and senators. So we were very much reliant on their speeches and their applying their knowledge and experience to their speeches. And we were there to help them with some editorial skill in presenting a rational verbatim report of their speeches, but really it was really their work that was being put into the Hansard.
So amongst the your colleagues and yourself, did you ever sort of after a session, after when during the period when you have time to sit down and talk, did you ever sort of talk about the politics of it all, or was that, were you mainly focused on the way to do a better job on what you were actually doing?
I don't recall any staff discussions about political issues, really. I might well have been the one who had taken the closest interest in politics among all the staff. I think it might have been one or two who had taken a more direct interest in politics, but not really. And basically, we were concentrating on doing the job of reporting the speeches, doing the editing work, getting the job done. And although I used to take a lot home with me, many of the others tried to separate their professional life from their home life and their social life, but just to make sure that they did as good a job as they possibly could, but then leave it at work and not let it interfere with their family and social life.
Got one Prime Minister left, Bob Hawke.
Hawke. Okay, so we've got 83 to 90. Again, highly educated. Again, a larrikin. But not all that obvious in the Parliament. And remember the major change in his whole lifestyle. When he came into the Parliament, and certainly when he became Prime Minister, where he became a teetotaler, became impeccably dressed. That's impression I have of most of them actually, but that just sticks in my mind a bit about Hawke and Keating, absolutely impeccably groomed and impeccably dressed always. And in Hawke's case, that was at odds with his years in the trade union movement. Certainly the larrikinism part and the drinking side of it were quite different. Highly educated, a good electioneering speaker, but nowhere near as good a speaker in the Parliament as people such as Whitlam, inclined to be, to engage in circumlocution, not concise. His language, his sentences were not concise, succinct sentences, inclined to ramble and repeat himself. So he required quite a bit of editing of his speeches. Again, I didn't have any personal contact with him. Certainly I don't recall his ever coming to the Hansard office for any reason. Or even much contact with his staff. Mm. Although I remember a girl who became his one of his personal secretaries, not his principal, a woman who'd been with him for donkey's years, but a younger girl who went on to his staff. I had met her, I remember, years ago when she had worked for Ken Reet. And that, I think I mentioned last interview that I went to Rabaul to report a Fisheries Council meeting, and she went to Rabaul with Ken Reet for that meeting, and we had, because he was the chairman of the meeting and she was one of his offsiders, we had liaised with her, so we had a little bit to do with her at that meeting, and from time to time we used to see her around the building after that, and then she came onto Bob Hawke's staff, and I think anything that we had to do with Bob Hawke's staff, which was very little, might have been done through her. So not a lot related to Hawke's time that I can remember. Certainly no personal dealings with him.
Okay, well, shall we take a short break here now?
Have a break, that'd be...
Okay.
Right.